And welcome now to The Midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we're playing a little bit of musical chairs in here, but welcome to my guest, Augustin Hadalich.
Hello. Hi.
good to see you again. I think your third visit to The Midday. And he's going to be performing with the Madison Symphony tomorrow night and Saturday night and Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, that's right.
In a program that includes Benjamin Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem and also the Symphony No. 1, that's the Spring Symphony of Robert Schumann, and the centerpiece, the Dvorak Violin Concerto. And you can read something about Augustin Hadalich in a recent issue of The New Yorker. A nice piece that is. Speaking of Benjamin Britten, you're talking on that occasion about performing with the Detroit Symphony and the Violin Concerto of Britten, which sounded like it was quite a challenge.
Yes, the Britten Violin Concerto is a wonderful, wonderful piece, which actually was neglected for the first 40, maybe 50 years of its existence, partially because of how difficult the solo violin part is.
Second movement, I guess, in particular.
Yes, there's some places that are barely playable, but it's a wonderful piece, and so I always enjoy playing it. But actually, the Dvorak that I'm playing here this week also didn't have the most easy start as a piece. This happens quite frequently when new concertos are written that just push the envelope in terms of the technical challenges they pose to the solist.
It's kind of inevitable, isn't it?
It happens every time that somebody says, oh, this isn't playable, blah, 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 blah.
Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev.
Yeah. It keeps happening. So so this one, Dvorak was, of course, very influenced by Johannes Brahms, but also by the Violin Concerto of Max Bruch, which had been written about 10-something years before. I'm a little hazy on the exact dates. I think it's about 10 years before the Dvorak Concerto. Mm-hmm. And was the most popular violin concerto at the time. So the Dvorak's piece follows very much the same form, actually, that the first movement is rather short. And after the exposition of the different themes and some development, it just goes into the second movement, transitions into the second movement. So it basically maybe half the length of a traditional first movement of a concerto. And it also starts in a very rhapsodic, free, almost, it sounds almost like an improvisation, the first entrances of the violinist, which is also how the Bruch concerto starts. And then the second movement is I would say the most important in the Dvorak. It's the longest. It's very very lyrical and emotional. And
you don't usually think of a second movement as being the most difficult, though. Usually, you think it'd be the faster outer movements.
Yes, I'm not sure that it's the most difficult technically, but it's certainly the one that's at the heart of the concerto. Mm-hmm. This the second movement in the Dvorak. So. And he, it's very beautiful and really takes its time. And then the last movement is a lot of fun. It's sort of a rondo form, the whole piece is very Czech. So Dvorak was always somehow connected to his roots in that way.
I know, even when he was writing in America, his New World Symphony and some of his chamber music, brilliant stuff that he wrote in this country, people say, oh, it sounds so American. He says, well,
yes,
it's Czech.
It's interesting that the origin of the American style and even things that you hear in Copland and composers like that can be traced back to Dvorak and by extension back to Czech folk music somehow. So there are definitely elements of that. So the last movement is a what's called a Furiant rhythm, which is just a very fun dance with a Dumka in the middle. So it doesn't get more Czech and more Dvorak than that, and it's a lot of fun to play. But also his harmonic language, the way that the harmonies move and resolve, and is very comes very much out of the Czech tradition.
Interesting how many major composers wrote one major violin concerto, and Dvorak among them.
Yeah.
And now, speaking of styles, This is a work that is by Stravinsky, but based on an 18th century composer, Pergolesi. And so it's inevitably a blend of styles. Do you think, having recorded it, this Suite Italienne, that it's more Stravinsky than it is 18th century? Do you have a sense of that?
It's hard to say in this case, because he really did steal, very openly and unashamedly from Pergolesi. So the themes are kind of reproduced exactly as they were written by Pergolesi. But Stravinsky once said that that bad composers borrow ideas, but great composers steal them. And he just basically steals these themes by Pergolesi, which are very little known, and then Stravinskyfies them. So there's just, it almost sounds sometimes like, if you imagine an orchestra, because this is a transcription of an orchestral work, the Suite Italienne. So if you imagine an orchestra that's trying to play Pergolesi, but things go horribly wrong and people get off and start playing wrong notes, and it's a bit, there's always a bit of humor in it, but you can definitely hear, you can hear it's Baroque and you can hear it's modern. So it's, it's that unique Stravinsky mix.
Well, let's hear, what, maybe the second movement for this is one of your more recent recordings, too, from maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. And shall we try the Serenata from this suite?
Sure, yeah.
And so this is Augustin Haderlich, and also you'll hear the pianist Robert Kulik. Second movement from the Suite Italienne by Stravinsky, Augustin Haderlich, my guest today. the violinist there, with Robert Kulik as the pianist on one of his Augustin CDs called Echoes of Paris. And of course, Stravinsky spent a lot of time there and you could argue was influenced by the sounds of life in Paris. Do you think that you could characterize your overall style of playing and from that identify or describe as to how it has changed over the years? I mean, well, for example, you go back to listen to one of your earlier CDs, which, like most performers, you don't do.
Uh-huh.
You don't go
Not
back
so
and
often.
Stick your CDs in the player. Oh, I wonder how I sounded like. But do you have a sense of what your, if you were to describe your style, how would you describe it?
Well, you know, when I'm done with a CD, it's such a long process, such an intense process that I need to take some distance for a while. So I usually don't listen for a year or two. But then when I listen again, it's interesting when I hear it again because I do feel like that's different from how I would play it, from how I would play it now. Because your tastes change and also just a little bit. I don't think my sound has changed so much, but this particular CD was recorded on a different violin also, so it does sound a bit different.
That would make a difference. Yeah. What are you playing now?
I play on a Stradivarius that was made in 1723, and I got that violin in at the end of 2010. But this CD, even though it came out in 2011, was recorded in the summer of 2010 with the previous violin. So, yeah. But so it's hard to say how it changed, but I think that's over time, as you play works again and again, you sometimes, well, hopefully, but I think with the best works, you gain a deeper understanding and you keep finding new things in the work you hadn't noticed before. And I think that I feel that my playing has become more, I would say, expressive over time. When I was younger, I was quite impulsive in concert, and I was excited and energetic about many things. But certain passages, if I think about the Dvorak Concerto, I would say that definitely the second movement, the slow movement, has probably changed the most, as I've spent more time thinking about those themes and those harmonies and where things are going and the structure of the work. And so those things change over time. Actually, after every performance, I usually take stock a little bit and think about, well, what changed this time? You know, for example, sometimes the conductor might suggest something or even just say something to the orchestra that's really interesting that I really want to remember, that gave me interesting ideas. And so with everyone I collaborate, I get something.
That's true. If you're performing a concerto with an orchestra, then it's not just you. It's like all the ideas that kind of flow into the rehearsals and the performances.
Well, I think the best thing about being a violinist, there are two great things. One is you never run out of good things to play because there's so much great, so much great repertoire.
Yes.
So that's really wonderful that I get to play so many different pieces that I all like so much. But the other great thing is that you usually don't play by yourself. It's very most of the repertoire is with other people. It's either with piano, or it's chamber music and ensembles, or it's violin concertos. But in a way, it's all the same thing, that it is that you're playing with other people and following and leading. And that, in that sense, it's not really possible to get bored with it, because every time you play it with a new person, it's something about it is different and the piece changes and my playing changes. I can't help but play differently with each conductor, for example. And when you play, of course, there's very important repertoire written for solo violin.
We'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah. Well, starting with Bach and then Paganini and all these important works. And that's a totally different way of playing. Suddenly, it's only you. You have all the responsibility. And of course, I mean, there are advantages to that you can go anywhere, take out your violin and play the piece. Without rehearsal. But
without guidance.
Yes. And without, other people to just give you feedback. So it's a different way of yeah, different way of making music. But of course, in these works, these composers have all tried to write music that is polyphonic, that has more than often has more than one voice. Even though the violin was originally created to be an instrument with just one voice, just a melodic instrument, that they start writing music with a lot of chords and with different voices. Yeah, that's where the challenge is. But in a way, sometimes you impersonate several people at once.
So, speaking of solo violin, violin only, you have actually your most recent recording.
Yes.
All 24 of the 24 Paganini Caprices for solo violin. And what did you use for your points of reference for that? Does Paganini give a lot of suggestions in the way that he, notates the music?
You know, it's pretty bare, his manuscript. But one thing that's great is that nowadays you can look at the manuscript for free online. And actually, quite a lot of notes were different from how everyone had been playing the Paganini Caprices for a long time. Because every time they were published, new mistakes or alterations were introduced, and so it's somewhat different. But I have a suspicion, actually, that he might have made these caprices even more difficult for publication, because he was always looking to promote his own legend, the legend of the violinist who sold his soul to the devil and could do the impossible. So maybe he made them just a little bit harder still than he might have performed them.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it quite that way with Paganini, but yes, he would not be beyond that. So what about this most famous of all solo caprices, the 24th, which has spawned so many sets of variations, including, of course, the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini of Rachmaninoff. What do you do with that?
Yeah, well, this is... You know, it's funny, whenever I've performed this piece, everyone recognizes it immediately. As soon as I play the theme, there's just like, you hear chuckles in the audience. And then people come up to me afterwards and somebody says, I have heard that song on guitar. I didn't know there was a violin transcription. So people are often they don't know that the violin version came first.
Yeah.
And it already was actually his most popular work during his lifetime. He knew this was the most popular, so he put it last. Uh-huh. In the collection, and was already famous back then.
Well, here we go. This is Augustin Hadalich with the Paganini Caprice number 24.
Thank you.
Does pull all the stops, doesn't he, Paganini, there in that 24th climactic caprice out of 24. Augustin Hadelich, the violinist there, what did you think? When you listen to your stuff, this is the most recent thing we have. Would you do it any differently if you were playing it tonight?
I would probably already do it differently, which is why I try not to listen to this recording very much, because so I recorded the 24 caprices between summer of 2016 and summer of 2017, and I did them in, because they are all so very difficult and taxing and demanding, I did them in four groups of caprices and over time, and it really did was like all I thought about for a while, and of course sure. I've been playing them for most of my life, especially this one. But it feels good to have this, have made this CD, because it had been something that I'd kind of dreamt of doing even when I was growing up.
Well, yeah, and nice to have that satisfaction, tangible satisfaction of having it in your hand and knowing that it's there for posterity. Augustin Hadelich will be performing with the Madison Symphony tomorrow night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30. He'll be performing the Dvorak Violin Concerto with its lovely second movement in particular. And also on the program, Benjamin Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem and Schumann's Symphony No. 1, the Spring Symphony, which I'm sure people out there are saying, well, I'm ready for that one, ready for spring. Anyway, thanks for stopping by the midday. It's been a pleasure having you on the show again.
Thank you so much. Great to see you.